Thank you all for showing up so nice, bright, and early. Thank you also for figuring out that we're not next door. We're in this room. This is your space, my space, D space, finding a place for institutional electronic records. And welcome for the first session of the conference. We are being tape recorded, so at the end when we do question and answer, I'll probably try to repeat questions. If I get your question not exactly right, let me know. My name's Tamar Chute. I'm the Associate Archivist at Ohio State University. Our version of DSpace is called the Knowledge Bank. The archives collection has mostly consisted of oral history transcripts and a few university films. But the President's Office sent the archives our outgoing President's correspondence, speeches, and presentations on CD. And I thought, wow, here's an opportunity to see how good DSpace is for institutional records. But we didn't get anywhere. The questions were too numerous. How do we deal with series? How much metadata do we need? Did every speech need to include detailed information on the audience and where she spoke, etc.? Even though the correspondence is considered a public record, Ohio has a very open public records law. What about any privacy concerns about personnel records that might be in there? Should we explore dark archives where just a placeholder existed? I was very frustrated with the people responsible for Knowledge Bank, so I decided to investigate what other institutions were doing. And from there, this session was born. I'll start by introducing our panelists. First on my, on your left is Tim Pyatt. Tim is the Duke University Archivist and Associate Director of the Rare Book, Manuscript, and Special Collections Library. A 1981 graduate of Duke University, Tim was appointed University Archivist in March 2002. He came to Duke from UNC, where he was Director of the Southern Historical Collection and Curator of Manuscripts. Tim also taught archival administration at UNC in their School of Information and Library Science from 1998 to 2007. Tim has held several elected offices for SAA, is past president of the Society of North Carolina Archivists, and was appointed by the governor to serve on the State Historical Records Advisory Board from 2000 to 2005. At Duke, Tim serves on a number of campus committees, including Commencement, Founders Day, and honorary degrees. Next, we have Aaron O'Mara. Aaron is currently the Electronic Records Archivist at the University of Oregon. She received a Master's of Archival Studies in 2004 from the University of British Columbia. While at UBC, she conducted research for the Inter Pares II project pertaining to archaeological records managed in geographic information systems. Aaron was an NHPRC Electronic Records Research Fellow in 2006-2007. Her research focused on a record-keeping framework for social scientists conducting data-intensive research. Finally, we have Nancy Dromedy. Nancy is Associate Archivist for the University Archives within the Bentley Historical Library at the University of Michigan. She is a 1997 graduate of the School of Information at the University of Michigan and was appointed Assistant Archivist at the Bentley Library in 1998. Nancy began working on digital records when she was still a graduate student with the collection of former university president James Duderstadt. This collection quickly revealed the perils of technological obsolescence. Since then, Nancy has worked on numerous digital initiatives, such as setting up processes for the transfer of key university records to the university archives and serving on the committee for the implementation of a university-wide blogging service. She has been a regular lecturer in the Archives Practicum course taught in collaboration with the Bentley Library. Now, each of the three panelists will begin by describing the types of material in their institutional repositories, what has worked for them, and what problems have arisen. Following their brief presentations, we will open the floor for questions and answers regarding DSpace or institutional repositories in general. So, Tim?
All right, I passed the first technology test. Thanks, Tamar, for the introduction. I'm going to talk about Duke Space, the right space for electronic records, with a question. Actually, it should be the right space for electronic records, sort of talking about it, because I think one of the things you'll sort of hear is the theme about sort of we're trying to use a tool that's not necessarily designed to do what we're trying to do. So talk a little bit about that. The other thing I think is kind of interesting about the three presentations that you'll hear is that there's a different administrative model for the Duke Space instances at the three campuses. And so I think that's another kind of theme besides what we're trying to do with it. So on the screen, I've got sort of the homepage for Duke Space there, and it's pretty much the vanilla out of the box with just our sort of custom banner and a little bit of text installation of DSpace, and I'll talk a little bit more about that. Just to give you the very brief sort of prehistory of how Duke Space came about at Duke. In 2002, I was hired as university archivist. We, at that point, did not have an electronic records program. We didn't have a lot of different things, but that was one of the things that I was sort of charged with when I was hired, was to start looking at what we should be doing with more digital content on campus. There were several different iterations over the course of the years, but sort of we'll fast forward to 2006, where in order to sort of to get us really jump-started on doing something, I volunteered to help out with the electronic submission of theses and dissertations, and that kind of got to the tipping point, because then we actually had a tool. We had something that would need a tool for access, and I knew if I could get that, if I managed the site for the theses and dissertations, I would have a site that I could also play around with electronic records. So, in taking on that responsibility, we also were able to launch our first pilot of Duke Space. And I'm happy, I don't know if Tom Roscoe is in the audience here, but this was happening right about the 2006 SAA conference in D.C., and I was talking to Tom in a hallway conversation about we were getting ready to launch a thing at DSpace, and Tom's at MIT, for those of you who don't know Tom. And I said, what should we call it? He says, you should call it Duke Space. So I give him the footnote for the naming of Duke Space. So it's the SAA. You just never know what those hallway conversations are going to lead to. So our site is actually managed by the University Archives staff. Seth Shaw, who is our electronic records archivist, is the sort of the main site manager with some technical support from our library IT. So it's a fairly small-scale operation. So this is the basic structure of the live production site you see up there. We have a University Archives community. For those of you who aren't familiar with DSpace, and I'll talk a little bit further about this, and you'll hear more about it, it's divided into communities, sub-communities, and collections. And so we have a community for dissertations, but the community I'm going to focus on for today is the community on University Archives, because that's where I have been experimenting with our born digital content. The reason why we sort of chose DSpace to work on this is the price was right. It was free, but it's sort of, as with all open source products, the cost isn't in the actual application. It's in all the staff time to make it run. And so as I mentioned before, this is a fairly small-scale operation. We really have fairly limited IT support. So we've done mostly an out-of-the-box installation, which is not particularly user-friendly, which is one of the downsides for those of you who have played around and looked at DSpace. But it's very functional, and it's one that folks with limited IT backgrounds, like such as myself, can sort of understand how to do sort of the basic management. And fortunately, our electronic records archivist can do even more with that end. So our idea with the I'll just say it, so I'm sure it's hard to see there, but the idea is we've got the University Archives community. And then we have set up several collections there. One is campus publications and reports. Others are materials from our Office of News and Communications. That's our public relations department. And then things from Office of the President. And basically what we started off with is we decided the sort of the policy of the content that would go into Duke Space would be content that we would have normally received in paper format, but we're now receiving electronically. And these would be things that could be publicly open. We sort of wanted to go with sort of the lowest common denominator and the kind of simplest things to start off with. The other two pieces of content that we wanted to test early on were websites and blogs, and I'll sort of talk a little bit further about some of the difficulties. We've not been able to do those yet because of sort of some of the descriptive challenges. So the first thing we tested in Duke Space was our press releases using the news releases done by the Office of News and Communications at Duke. And this sort of shows up one of the sort of descriptive flaws. If many of you who've worked in digitized analog collections know the sort of the default is one item, one description. And unfortunately, DSpace, just like most institutional repository software, sort of has that same default. If you've got an item, it wants to have a discrete description for that item. And so what we were trying to do was sort of process it very much in the same kind of way we would process the paper records, trying to do folder level, series level descriptions. And some things scaled and some things didn't scale as well. I tried as an experiment to do all the press releases for 1992 in one single record, because I could script in loading all those 300 press releases for one record. But the problem is, as you can sort of see on this screen, you've got the sort of basic boilerplate description at the, there, and then you've got all these press releases. And when you do a search result, what happens is when you view a full-text search, it'll bring up the record for what you're looking for there, but it brings up that record, and it doesn't tell you which one of those files actually has your search result in it. So you get that, you know, record, but so it's very hard then to drill through. It's sort of like giving a patron an unprocessed box of records and said, the paper you want is somewhere in this box. Good luck finding it. It's sort of the way, the problem we've had thus far with sort of the initial thing for doing that level of description. And that sort of leads me sort of my next slide, is I kind of... One of the things that was kind of appealing to us about DSpace when we got into it is it sort of, you know, for those of you who, I used to teach Intro to Archives for years, and one of the things I always do, I would do the Holmes, you know, five levels of description. And so, you know, on the surface, DSpace hierarchy really matches up very well with the Holmes level of description. You've got the DSpace as the repository, which could be the repository. You've got the community, which could be, you know, be the collection. And you've got sub-community, which could be series. And then you've got the collection, and then you've got the items. But the problem is it doesn't scale. You can have multiple communities, and within those communities, you can have multiple sub-communities, and then within the sub-communities, you can have multiple collections. But only only collections can have those items, and only the items can have the actual files attached to them. And so what happens is you can't sort of scale that up and down where you have the items at different levels. So it really sort of drills down that you're at that item level description, no matter how many layers of hierarchy you put into the. Into it, which has been one of the sort of challenges in trying to make archival records sort of fit the IR model. There is on the surface it looks like it's got the layers, but in actuality we haven't had the layers work as well for us. So this is now we were fortunate this spring we were able to load up a development site, so we have a little sandbox that we can play in without messing up stuff on our production server. And this is the sandbox screen here. Sort of showing how we've done it. And what we've tried to do is sort of play around with, you know, we still have the collections, and this is within the sandbox for the university archives community. But we've started playing with trying to do more sub-communities and trying to do more hierarchy to try to do a little better description. And so what we've actually done now is we've sort of tried to script up, and actually we sort of, if you can't beat them, join them, we've taken now and made, you know, collections sort of at the series level. So before where you had like an item level for press releases, we now have, if you see the collections in this community, we have the news release collection. And we actually then go down and actually have our script in individual records for each individual press release. Now the beauty with that is we're iTunes University, we do YouTube, and so almost every press release now has a media file associated with it. So as we get that content in, we can actually associate with this record the whatever media went with the press release, so we can actually have that all sort of nicely bundled into one item. The key is sort of automating the process so that we're not hand putting in all those individual items. So it is working a little better for us in that area. The good news for us as we're playing the development server is also the library decided last fall to really sort of, you know, that they decided to that we'd be passed beyond the pilot stage into production stage. And so we're finding a higher level of institutional support for what we're doing with DukeSpace, which has been sort of key. The other big thing is then the graduate school is moving towards mandatory submission of electronic theses and dissertations. And so since this is the repository for the circulating copy of, we don't get any paper in. It puts a lot of, you know, it helps to sort of have our effort piggybacked on with this sort of mandate from outside of the library and the campus. And so it has helped gain support for the process. So where we're going from here is trying to, you know, we're still trying to figure out how to make that sort of the scales work so we're not having to do item level description with the repository. And we're also now, we're on the sandbox, we've just loaded up Mannequin, which is a University of Texas cooperative thing with the with MIT, and sort of doing a new user interface on it to make it much more usable. It won't help so much with the descriptive levels, but you can even see from this test screen, much more friendly for, has the search boxes right up to the top, a little more administrative information. It's just a much more friendly way, and this is actually just our first test at sort of trying to mush around and make it into a more friendly user space. So with that, I'll stop because you're going to hear lots of great stuff from my colleagues here, and so that'll give you a little feel about how Duke tries to try to work with DSpace for institutional records. So I'll turn it over to Aaron.
So I'm going to have a really brief presentation about our instance of DSpace as well at the University of Oregon. really similar to Tim's, primarily screenshots. Our background is a little bit different with DSpace. It was installed in 2004 as our institutional repository, and it was primarily focused on scholarly communications. So scholarly output, but there were actually electronic records deposited at that first instance in 2004, more as a placeholder. There was no other place to put these records that we had. They were a diploma, I think, in all the associated records we had gotten for a honorary diploma. So we had put electronic records in there, but I think within the university archives, the university historian and archivist, Heather Briston, was there. I was not there in 2004, and really was thinking that there would be a separate home for electronic records. So DSpace wasn't our sort of first thoughts, but it was a place to put records and have them very accessible and visible within campus. Our DSpace instance is called Scholars Bank, and this is what it looks like. It is also a very sort of simple instance of DSpace. We have various communities in here that pertain to different units on campus. So it's grown to not just include scholarly output, but there are university publications, there are government documents. We have a whole local community's data set and groups of records within government documents, and we also have university archives. So it's, as you can see, it's pretty similar. You can customize it if you haven't used this before, but it kind of looks similar to Duke Space. It's green instead of blue. So unfortunately, currently we are meshed into the communities within a Scholars Bank. So there are departmental organizations within it that contain scholarly, papers and departmental newsletters, but then there's a whole section within special collections and university archives that contains our electronic records. So we are buried really, really, really deep into the system. And as Tim was talking about, the hierarchy really doesn't make access, if you go to the homepage and try to find electronic records, that easy. So if you drill down, here we go. So you go to Special Collections and University Archives. Then you open up the Electronic Records Community homepage. And within this, we've kind of mirrored the org chart of the university. The problem that we found was that it organizes alphabetically by order. And in order to not customize to create problems in migration, which we were finding with when we were updating to the mannequin install as well, was that we actually are using prefixes. So we're using numeric prefixes within each unit so that it organizes based on our organizational hierarchy, not alphabetically, which kind of looks clunky. But this is what we've done so far. We currently have about 100 records, I think, electronic records within our instance, and that has happened within the past year. But we are still working out the kinks as well. So we'll drill down further. And this is within graduate studies, within a myriad of organizational units that you have to drill down through within the communities area. And you get into graduate studies, and then you can get in and see graduate council minutes, and they're listed below. And then here's an item record, like Tim's item records is really similar. So these are the minutes from February. So it's really similar. I think one of our concerns is the access point as well, as Tim was talking about. It's a challenge. But I'll talk about that in a minute. I kind of wanted to talk about kind of the things we went through when we were starting to populate our electronic records section. So we wanted to customize to an extent, but not too much. We're going through the mannequin install and upgrade right now, and I know that a lot of people have been concerned about customization beyond the point of then being able to move forward into a new version of DSpace. So we've really tried to work with what we have and keep it simple.
We reviewed the current institutional repository metadata schema that was used and deployed. We have a steering committee for the IR that developed that, and we made sure that it fit our needs. We did a little bit of customization, and of course our workflow is different when we ingest our materials and then have descriptive information at the back end. And we always have to remember it's an access point, not a repository. So we've planned accordingly. We also have these records in their original format, as well as the PDF. We transform things into PDFs for the most part, websites as well as Word documents. And so we have that and the original native format in a secure server that houses our digital collections and other long-term digital files. So collaboration is our other sort of thing that we rely on. This isn't just a university archives instance. It's the whole university's IR. So collaborating with the existing technical services staff that upload the other files has actually been has worked to our advantage. We've been able to get help. I've been using a graduate student intern to do a lot of the work, and also another staff person that was in technical services. So we've been able to leverage resources, which was really exciting because otherwise it would have been a really daunting task within the archives to try to do this project. I don't think we'd have 100 records in there right now if it wasn't for the fact that this was a library-wide project. So that was really exciting. Now to the issues. We face a lot of the same issues that Tim was talking about. We have decontextualized access. Something that just came up recently was that it's almost too good, the access is almost too good. We uploaded an organizational chart from the vice provost for finance and administration, and we described it, and it was a PDF already, so we just ingested the PDF, and she had some staffing changes, and so she took down her org chart, and she was looking to make sure it was taken down, and she found the PDF in DSpace actually trumped her website that had taken the org chart down but was still indexed in Google, and ours was above it. And when you go in with our configuration, it unfortunately doesn't go to that item level record. It goes straight to the PDF without any DSpace borders on the side, which kind of alert that you're in DSpace. So there was a bit of concern at the administration building about what was going on and if we could take down the records within the archives component, specifically the org chart. So we're really trying to figure that out, how to actually provide context within the framework that we have and the technology we have, and how we can do that with our resources. So it was something that we weren't expecting, that it would really actually trump the original sites from where some of the content originates or where they've posted it online. So it was pretty interesting and created a challenge of trying to sell this to a unit and then they've already had a weird experience with it. So that was a challenge that we really didn't know was going to occur. And then the customization issues, which I've already touched upon. Thankfully, we hadn't customized too much. So our mannequin install, we're at the test server phase as well. So we have a sandbox that we're doing, and we're hoping now to split out the different units. So within our institutional repository, you will go to a home page that will then have links to separate portals. So there will be a portal for scholarly output. There will be a portal for university archives, and there will be a portal for government docs, as well as one for ETDs. So that will be really exciting because we hope that it will help showcase the collections in the areas in which they were sort of the needs were supposed to be served. So it's a challenge because currently a lot of the scholarly communications issues that we face is why are there departmental meeting minutes in the institutional repository if this is where I'm supposed to put my faculty paper, because it's supposed to help, it's supposed to help raise awareness. So we're really trying to help mitigate those issues now that it's grown beyond just that area. So that is all I have to say, and hopefully we can just have questions afterwards. So.
Hello, my name's Nancy Duramity, and I'm from the Bentley Historical Library at the University of Michigan. And I will go over how our development of what we call Deep Blue has developed over, I think it was 2004 that we also started, but I'm not positive on that. But I do want to mention, as Tim noted in his presentation, that each of our instances have really been set up differently, and ours is within the university library, and it's managed within the library, the technical services there, and we're outside the library, though. The university archives is a separate library within the university system, and we report to the provost, so there's one difference there, I think. But what the University of Michigan did when they went to implement their instance of I can't remember the DSpace, yeah, was to identify the partners on campus that this would affect, and then to go around, and they did these intense interviews with everyone that this would be involved to see how the system would overlap or not overlap. Oops. So they were asking questions like, you know, how do we make it clear to the users what content goes in this repository, and where does other content go? With this partnership, we were asked then to be part of the advisory group for the development of the instance, and we helped establish the collections policy, the intellectual property policy, the access policy, and the digital preservation policy. And all of those are on the website, which I will end with. It's also here, but it's probably hard to see. And this, again, is our interface that looks like Tim and Aaron's as well. The one thing I did want to say about the preservation policy, and I'm not sure, and we can talk about that later too, is that we spent a lot of time deciding which file formats line up with the highest level of preservation. So we have the highest level of preservation, limited preservation, and as-is preservation. And I was part of that committee with others from the library and some from the School of Information. But we also found it was an opportunity to try and educate or raise the awareness with the faculty about file formats and what they're try to put some of the burden back on the faculty. So we also wrote guidelines on how to create like a good PDFA, or how to do what's the difference between audio files, and how do I create a better one. So those are online as well. And I think that it has raised their awareness across the campus. We have collections, not communities. That's just a cultural thing at U of M. They couldn't fit themselves into communities, so they decided to skip that hierarchy. And there's right now about 44,000 items in 65 collections. They've also found, which I think is really interesting, that the search is mainly through Google. It's not coming through the library system. And I'm just going to end with the project we've been involved with, most heavily involved with, is working with a unit who has gone from the print to the digital, and using the repository, using our Deep Blue as the repository for this university collection, for this archival collection, and working through some of the issues. And the particular collection is the Michigan Today. It's an alumni newspaper. It's been around the university campus since 1968. And like other digital publications and records, it started to transform itself over the last few years. So it went from print to them trying an e-newsletter for a while. Then they did online, and they did a print publication. And there was not really much consistency with what was happening. There was a lot of broken links. They had an archive online, but it wasn't complete. There, like I said, there was a lot of broken links. There were some issues not there. And so we approached them because We thought it was an important collection, and we saw a lot that they, well, and the other thing is they went completely digital last fall. So we wanted to talk to them about creating a really complete archival collection. This is the current issue online. And like I said, they have a back issues archive, and they actually have two separate links to their archive because of the differences in format over the years. So it's very confusing for users anyway to try and find a back issue because it says, like, if you're looking from 2004 to present, you use this link, and then the old print edition is this other link. So it really wasn't working very well anyway. We help teach a class with School of Information last winter term, and it was a practicum. So I had a student named Courtney Egan help work on this project, and she did a great job. What we worked through was looking at the total picture from the print to the what happened in between to what's happening now. And that included analysis of the current online version and recommending changes. And a lot of the changes were process type changes. We also saw that our Deep Blue would work as a good repository for this type of collection. There's not sensitive or confidential material, and it's a collection that we'd want to share across the university, and that's why we partnered with them. They also have been a great partner. We customized our metadata for this particular collection, and with them providing a stable URL, we thought that was very beneficial. Our users were not expecting them to go through this particular interface, but there was a interface designed for the collection because we came across problems like Aaron had mentioned about what is current, what is archived. And so there is a portal that distinguishes between, it has a wrapper that will say university or archive, and this is an archive version of the Michigan Today. This has been a project of the University Archives, Michigan Today, and Deep Blue. So we were really, with earlier web captures, we came across that problem a while ago that becomes an issue with units. And this is a draft of what the interface will look like. And there's different points when you click on, like, Michigan Today Archive, it'll give you a script that says this has been a project of the Bentley Library and Michigan Today and Deep Blue. So other things that I wanted to mention, search was really important for the Michigan Today because they're part of our news and information division. So they're doing their own search engine for this as well. They have people working on a separate search, so that's very granular, and it will take them pretty much to the exact issue that they want, but that requires a lot more work on their part. And like Tim said, by ingesting this into the Deep Blue, we will have separate media files for not just the text, but audio, video, and images. We thought it was really important to have the context. So this will link from the Bentley Library website to the portal, the last page I showed. But our online catalog record will also point to the portal, as well as the other records that are in the library, the other Michigan Today records, and to the finding aid, of course. So I think that's all I have for now, and we'll take some questions now.
We left a lot of time for question and answer because that was the whole point of the session. And so I guess I'll start off with one of, I have a lot of questions, but hopefully you all do too, because otherwise I'm going to just talk. I'd like to ask each panelist, what is the best and worst use of DSpace in your institutional repository? Who wants to go first? Flip a coin.
I'll do the political response, so I won't answer the question directly. I think one of the things, I mean, this is, I think, both, it's more of a policy thing than a best use, is that it was one of the things I didn't sort of emphasize, it was different, and that is DukeSpace is not an open repository, it's not an institutional repository, it's basically what goes in there. The policy is content, it's dictated by university archive staff and library policy, and there's very little self-submission, so it's not open up for faculty scholarship, which I think is a plus because we have total control over what's going in. And you can, sort of the same kind of thing like you know, deciding like what goes into the university archives. You get record schedules and those kind of things. So it really mirrors the sort of administrative structure that we have for the archives. So that's the plus of it, but it's also sort of the downside too, because it doesn't get the same kind of awareness as if you've got the sort of broad base sort of bringing the faculty in. So I can sort of see within both the Michigan and the Oregon one, you know, you run the challenge of having the archival component buried, but then you've got the broader campus support. So in a roundabout way, sort of our administrative structure is both a strength and a weakness, I think, of our system.
I guess I'll follow up more with Tim's comments than with that question, because I can't think of the worst incident. But we have found, too, that it's open for faculty to ingest or to deposit materials themselves, and departments can deposit, but that's not really happening. It's really happening either through the archives or through the library collections people. So there is control. I think that the project leader for our Deep Blue wouldn't mind some more business, regular deposits, but it just still isn't happening. It's taking, which isn't bad either, it's taking, we're still playing the role of the curator of the collections and what's coming in and soliciting material.
Okay, I can, well, I'll say something a little bit juicier, I guess, just so we can have something juicy to say. The reason that we started actually doing a lot of the ingest recently, which was primarily web harvesting of documents over the last few months, and then this fall we'll actually be doing actually ingesting collections that were received, is because we went through a university accreditation cycle about a year ago, and we found out that there were people in the library that needed documents started uploading university records into DSpace within a reports and documentations community. Just that's what it was called. It wasn't affiliated with any unit or departmental, affiliation. And so when we found out that was happening, we realized we needed to start creating an actual arena and documents within an organizational structure so that community would be sort of stopped. So I think that was our least favorite thing that happened out of the thing, because we have self-submission. That could happen. Anyone can submit, any faculty member can submit records into the community. But what happened was that the communication, we didn't find out until after they had been submitted and approved within the IR that had happened. But then it was also positive because it made us move forward. It means that our instance isn't perfect right now, and that we found out about some of these access issues, but it made us move forward, which was good. So okay. There's a little juicy thing.
Yeah. I wonder if the question, and again, I apologize, I have to repeat it for the recording, but the question is if anybody has email currently in DSpace, and also if they found that with Google finding documents, if additional metadata or some sort of information has to be added to the documents so that when people find it through Google, they know more about where they are.
Okay.
At the University of Michigan, we do not have email in our Deep Blue. We have email collections. At this point, it's not a collection I would put in Deep Blue, because we're viewing our repository as more of a broad, open, campus-wide access, and usually at least the email we've received has some type of restriction, so it's not something that we would publicly put out there. And that could change sometime this year, but it's not, like I said, it's not the type of repository we're viewing for that type of material.
Yeah, I'll add to that, yeah, because with DSpace, it's really, it's totally out there, and as you've heard from the Google indexing, it really is out there, or it's, you know, it's totally dark to just whoever deposited it. So it's yeah, you really don't have a lot. That's one of the sort of, you know, in this kind of tiers of level of description, one or restriction. You know, we've been looking at trying to do some things with, you know, trying to have IP restricted communities and some of the other kind of things, which is possible. It's just not part of the standard. You've got to program it in yourself. It's not part of the standard configuration. So for right now, for email, it just is not particularly. Well, there's also sort of other sort of how to present it and describe it, sort of how you're going to package it up, depending on how the body of it is. There's sort of the presentation piece, which is challenging, but then there's also just the, you know, the access issue, which is even more so.
Yeah, we don't have email in there either. It is a challenge, the Google component that you're talking about, at least with the configuration at Oregon. It's configured for access at the document level, because in Google that's what people want, is they want to get to the document. They don't want to get to the metadata records. So that's how the OYSTER, the Open Access Initiative sort of harvesting tool that is, you can use in DSpace to make them so, the records so highly indexed in Google, it's indexed to the record. It's not indexed to that metadata record, at least in our instance. I think you can customize it potentially. We haven't investigated that, but we're looking into some other way.
You could potentially watermark the document or do something like that, where, because it's going to be hard to, you know, with the way Google does it, it doesn't want to go to the document. We've had a similar experience to Aaron, where you're kind of pleased that someone's actually found something that you put in there, but if you're also unpleased when the dean of the law school is calling up to complain and says, we just issued the new strategic plan, and the old strategic plan for the law school actually comes up higher in Google rankings than the new one. And we didn't, you know, it was very unhappy. You know, he wanted me to figure out how to make it so it wouldn't be quite so. He didn't mind it being accessible, he just didn't want it to be that accessible. It was just kind of.
Yeah.
The comment is, on the other hand, isn't this a way to get more metadata, or forces us to put in more metadata?
Yeah.
Because the newer documents are not getting as much relevance in Google as the originals.
Yeah, I think that's what's going to happen, is they'll actually have to figure out how to index above.
Except the reality is the, you know, if you particularly for the ones that all the literature shows for when it's faculty and offices doing self-submission, they're going to do the, no matter what you require, they're going to do the bare minimal metadata. You know, it's going to take, you know, archive staff or administrative staff to go and enhance the data. That's the real downfall, is, you know, it really is ultimately going to fall back on whoever's running the repository for whatever metadata that you want, because it just, you know, studies have shown and practice have shown that you're not going to get it from the folks submitting.
The woman in the pink? I saw your hand first. That's you. Yes. Okay, the question, to paraphrase, is how has your experience with DSpace changed your views as archivists in terms of metadata, if we need more description or less description, appraisal concerns, and are we wedded to series or should we look elsewhere?
I think it's a very relevant question, because one of the things, I mean, as you see the current generation of undergraduates and the, you know, the people who are younger generation than myself that do research, they don't think in the same way. And so some of the things that the Holmes five level descriptions, which is very much in my mind, you know, they're so, you know, used to going and doing the keyword Google search and getting the returns back. And so, you know, part of it, I think there is probably a need to sort of rethink a little bit about how we do things. I'm not, because I have no confidence that the tools are going to adapt to the level of description and kind of things that we have done in the past. And so how do we make the system work without losing the context of the records? Because that's the problem, is it still sort of defaults down to the item levels. And when you're dealing with archives, isolated items sometimes really don't have much meaning unless you know the fuller picture on it. And that's true with electronic records. So some truths still seem to be there, but sort of how to bring that all together, I don't have the answer yet.
It really has sort of changed my idea and made me think a lot about sort of access to university archives records. And it made me really, really appreciate getting the documents out there, regardless of it being a perfect arrangement, regardless if we don't have the paper series associated with these records, but that we are getting access. We're really, really providing that access point. I think another thing that one thing that we're investigating about that is within our consortial EAD, we have Northwest Digital Archives within our region. So it's a consortial website that has EAD records for various institutions within the Northwest. And one of our ultimate goals would be to link the persistent handles from DSpace in those finding aids so that we still so we can maintain that traditional access point as well as creating the Google immediate access point. And that might be a way that we can, and you can really easily insert handles into those into your encoded finding aids. It is adding a lot more work to what we do and description, so I really think it's a good point time to reflect on what we're doing and prioritizing what's important for the user. Because you know, I want to do that because it really does relate to the hierarchical and contextual linkages that we want with our records. But is that what the users are they going to appreciate that? And if there's only one link within that finding aid, will they even utilize it? So, yeah.
I think that's a really good question as well. And I would say that the role, or I think that this last project, the role is really emphasized for me is the appraisal piece. That's what I think the other units were looking towards us for the most. And I think description's really important for our, I think you have to call like our university units our customers, our users. But it's that they do want usually that item level. And finding aids, I like to have the context and the link to the finding aid, but I think in the future it's more about just getting that document, that information. That's what they want, and they want it, you know, want it online. And I'm not sure if they will go through finding aids. I think it's just going to keep evolving to be the keyword search on Google. And I agree with Erin, we probably need to look into something more so that we can incorporate our finding aids easier. But I think that's really the role of the archivist, I think, has really is changing, and we're being looked at as a consultant, especially on appraisal.
Yes.
Yeah,
David Nell from Wisconsin. Most of what we put into our repository so far has been things like catalogs or schedule classes, things like that. And one thing we struggle with is how we designate something as being the official, authoritative, non-liquid version of something. And we looked at wording from Michigan, and they probably stole some of that. But as an example, we were in a meeting a couple weeks ago of people from the graduate school, which has gone with all the electronic catalog, and they so far have nothing on their webpage saying that that's the official version of the graduate catalog. And so how do you all handle that question? Someone really needs to know that they're looking at the official, authoritative version of something.
Okay, the question is, how do the panelists show that that the record that the patron is looking at is the authoritative and official record of the university, be it bulletins or course descriptions or whatnot?
That's an interesting idea. Yeah, I'll jump on that first because this whole conversation has sort of introduced that I have a flaw in my system. not that I didn't know that we had flaws already, but this one I didn't realize is because we have that information is at the community and collection level, but then, of course, people are finding it out of isolation of the sort of hierarchy that I'm so wedded to. They're not seeing that this is the official record. The other sort of piece I'll add on to that also is in working with various offices is that we have offices that are very concerned, like the folks with course catalogs and like that, who are transferring stuff to us while they still have the quote, official version on their website. And so we've tried to, and this is the administrative overhead as this build is gets larger and larger to keep track of, is that, you know, we've got, you know, the course catalogs, the university registrar has got the official versions on his website and then has deposited them from us. At what point then do we deposit them into to DukeSpace and just, you know, and then, you know, ideally the registrar would link back for the backlog to the archives. And right now, it's a fairly labor-intensive sort of case-by-case basis working with that, because one of the things we didn't want to do is then we thought it would be even more confusing given the sort of the Google relevant searches is to have two exact versions of the same thing up at two different sites. We really thought that would add to some confusion by the user to have sort of two versions of the course catalog for Duke up for $19.99. So that's been one of our big challenges is sort of trying to work with the offices on that sort of demarcation. So it's not only just the official issue, it's like, when do you become the access point, too? That's also, I think, for that. And that sort of feeds into the official piece there, too, is that someone finds it, they want to make sure they're at the right one.
That's a good question. For this particular project for Michigan Today, it's in the description of the collection, which will be on the portal of Michigan Today. But I'm thinking now that you're right. There's not something right on the individual record. And probably the better, maybe something to think about is some type of watermark that can be put on the document.
Yeah, I'm similar to do.
I'm going to get somebody from this side of the table, whatever, room. Yes.
Good morning. My question is for Tim. I don't want to go to the server
space. Yeah, that's always probably.
We are in the same boat as you. Okay. The question is for Tim, and the woman asked if he had looked at the open source system Greenstone. And what are the requirements for server storage? Because her institution, like many of ours, I'm sure, does not want to give up storage space.
So as first the selection of the software, we looked at Greenstone, ePrint, Fedora, DSpace, and then two commercial products, ProQuest Digital Commons and Ex Libris's DigiLive, which was still under development in 2006, and so it was not one that we really actively pursued. And I, if any Duke people are out here, they'll laugh at me. Basically, we chose DSpace because we figured out how to install it. And knowing there was going to be a low IT overhead, that pretty much was there wasn't a lot of great difference between the products. They all had this sort of, each one had sort of fatal flaws in them. There was nothing perfect out there. And of course, with all IT solutions right now, all solutions are temporary. So in 3 to 5 years, you're going to be doing something anyway. And DSpace did seem to have a good export and migration part built into it so that we can move it to the next system. So that was sort of the basis for that. As for the server space, that was the bigger piece for that was in 2004 we got a dedicated server for storing sort of our archives, our stacks for the source electronic records. That was sort of the big hurdle was getting that space. For the production server, my pilot server did not have a lot of space, but again, the big key for getting space for that was getting the graduate school buy-in and being the man, having our site being the repository for the official site, the official access copy for Duke dissertations. That was the key that sort of has gotten the support. And I think on the archives piece alone, I get the president's office interested in a few things, so that helped a bit because we do the president's speeches up on Duke space, so that helps. But they take up very little space. But the having the official copies of the dissertations gave me the sort of leverage because I could get the dean of the graduate school to go if I had not that I've had to do that, but I could get the dean of the graduate school to push the library on that too. So it was seen as a core function, and so that was the real key to sort of getting the space and the resources that I needed.
Do either of you want to comment on storage space?
We have every digital collection, we run through a matrix, and it gets rated, and it's a pretty complex matrix. And we made sure to run this sort of digital project through the matrix, and within that, we allocated for growth. So we did work with the digital collections librarian to really make sure it was at that level, too, and incorporated in with all the other digital projects, to ensure that there was server space for the upcoming years. But knowing that, yes, in 3 to 5 years, we're hopefully that things might change, but that they at least know where our growth pattern will be. And I think that helped really put it on the playing field with all the other collections, and that could help at that point too. Using the Platter toolkit we use as well just to test out before we created our own digital collections matrix. That's a preservation planning tool, and that was just something we did to sort of see how that worked. but we have our own internal relevance matrix to put things in funding priorities within digital collections for the library.
Questions? Yeah. Okay, I'm going to try to say that again. The question was whether or not the panelists are worried about using an institutional repository for electronic records instead of a trusted system, especially since most institutional repositories come out of digital libraries, and whether or not their development will be a dark archive moving into the institutional repository.
I would say that we will have a separate instance. We do have a dark archive, and we have the access material in the institutional repository, so I don't see the two will ever be together.
Yeah, I'll add, we actually started off with the separate server for the source records, and that has, you know, it's totally separate, has very limited access, follows sort of the, you know, really strict protocols. But yes, but you know, maybe between the two we could sort of fudge and say we had the trusted one. But yeah, with our DSpace instance is a totally access, and even though it's not that great user friendly, it's still our total, that's our access copy, and we have the dark copy, the source copy, where we have the native file formats that we preserve and maintain. But your point is valid by having the two separate ones there, because it does come up sort of like, why am I getting double? You know, you have to explain every budget year why I need to grow the dark space as well as the production space. So yes, I mean there is, you know, it's I feel like I'm in a constant education program with that to explain that strategy.
And also the other education piece was we were finding it very challenging with just the dark space going to administration about selling the need for a repository, especially the access point. So having the instance of DSpace, but really ensuring that this is just the current solution. It's not a long-term solution, and it's not a preservation solution. Is, you know, it's much easier now to explain to administration what this is. The dark archive, you can't really. It's hard to sell a dark space, I think.
Yeah, again, it's sort of, you know, playing the campus politics things. One of the things that I have in the dark copy is the official electronic version of the Board of Trustee minutes, which at Duke are restricted for 50 years. And so that's always my trump card I can pull out when I say, well, you know, I've got to have this for the trustees. and the campus politics piece, I think, you know, is sort of the same kind of thing with, working with the electronic submission. If I hadn't done those kind of pieces like that, I don't think I would be where I am now. And so that's sort of one of the other kind of pieces that's very critical. It's sort of, you know, not just sort of doing, but making sure you've got some, you know, mission critical records that everyone recognizes are just, you know, part of the mission of the university, so that you can keep that leveraging that support. Mm-hmm.
Question is, if anyone has any audiovisual material in their version of DSpace and the challenges that they may have run into.
So far, we had a faculty collection this spring that we had audiovisual for, and we wanted deposited, and there wasn't an issue with the material itself, but more with the license, the copyright for the material. And that's where we got bogged down, because he did not have license agreement for the music of his material, and we recently met with our general counsel, and we're going to figure out how we can deposit in Deep Blue but restrict it only to two libraries on campus. So far, like, we haven't had the problems with the material itself depositing, but it's more with making sure the license and the copyright's cleared.
And DSpace does have ability to put the rights in, because we put in a couple things. We put in rights information. Yeah, we have a few items in. We're about to get slammed. They were ready last year, actually, to give them to me, and I keep holding them off. Is all the backlog of things that aren't up on YouTube and iTunes U at Duke from the sort of the earlier media file, which is in the media files from our news and communication folks, but they're very anxious to send over and let me sort of solve the problem with it, in which I'm sort of, you know, trying to make sure I've got a better structure before I get buried with them. But It's more the processing and management. Once you actually get it in there, we put them up as a QuickTime or Real Media, and they open up and play fine. Mm-hmm. It's not been hard. The hard part is sort of the ingest and getting it there. Once it's there, it seems to work fine.
I'd just like to follow up on that question. One of the problems that we've had at Ohio State, and I'd like to hear how the panelists have maybe addressed this, is with things like scrapbooks, where you have the DSpace forces you to individually catalog each page. And so if you're trying to look at a collection of one scrapbook, it's very difficult for to look at photographs that way. And I was wondering if anyone's tried to work with that, with photograph series maybe. No,
we haven't done it.
Anybody else?
I've seen people do they'll like have one record for the scrapbook and then have like, you know, you can put individual descriptions within the files and having it sort of like, you know, page by page, or having it sort of done as a series like that. But again, it's the same kind of thing. It sort of it reduces the searchability somewhat. If you want to individually search the pages, it's harder to do that way.
Mm-hmm. Some people merge the PDF too into one.
Yeah.
If they save it as a PDF, and then you can link, you can still have scroll down links. But usually, sometimes for access, we would put things in our content DM collections for image.
And this, since we have a whole separate, digital collection that's more for the digitized analog material. So a lot of that kind of thing, we have not gotten a lot of born digital photos yet to put in. Although I'm thinking now of a student group collection that was sent to me recently that could go in there, but which we haven't put in yet. So we'll have to address that soon.
Okay.
Just thinking, we have our student newspaper in Olive, which is a publications sort of software that really does an excellent job for searching. But we're also putting our photographic materials in Content DM, and we're looking at developing an institutional repository in DSpace for a number of the kinds of things that you're putting them in. And it just strikes me that as we begin to develop an array of different tools that seem to work well for different formats, this issue of people kind of bungling into the archival collections through Google, this seems like a bigger problem that's going to arise. I mean, we have so many people that don't know what the University Archives is or that it even exists. How do you propose, or what do you think we need to do to enable people to, having found a random University Archives document, then to be able to move on and explore the broader resources of the archives?
The question is, at Penn State they have a student newspaper in Olive, and photographs and Content DM, and they're looking at doing an institutional repository. With all the different tools for all the different types of formats, seems like a bigger problem where people don't even realize they may be at the archives or how to get to different material, and what's the best way perhaps to show people that they are at the archives and what further resources there may be, because obviously, just to add something, that our electronic material is usually much smaller than what our holdings are.
I'll take a stab at this daunting question, because we're right now at Duke. We're interviewing a position. We got a Mellon grant for a 4-year position that's going to be the Director of Digital Information Strategy for campus, which I sort of have dubbed the cat herder position, trying to get all the things going on campus. But it's interesting. I asked that person the same question because there's no institutional repository at Duke. We have we've got the digital repository, which is what I refer to DukeSpace as. The law school has its own for its faculty. There's a couple of departments that sort of have their own systems. So we have this whole multitude. And then the library has a multitude of systems doing the various digital collections. And so I broached this, I says, how do you bring this all together? And this candidate actually, in sort of a kind of a brilliant response, said, he says, we're not at the stage in this kind of development where there is, any kind of one-stop shopping. There's not going to be one tool out there that's going to solve all the problems. And so he says, I actually look at this as a plus because, assuming you can, people are open to talking to that, I can go out and sort of talk to them and find out what works and not works. And basically, I've got all these sort of lab projects going on, and so I've got all these sort of people field testing different tools. So that's for the multiplicity of tools. I thought that was a good sort of good response about the we're still at the stage where we need to be looking and figuring out what the best features of what and what can do what. And so if you've actually got all these people doing these various different products out there, you can see what works best. That still doesn't solve the problem of how to pull it all together. And if I had thought to ask him that question, maybe I'd have an answer for the second half. So so I haven't got a good answer for how to bring it all together.
I think that's a really good question, too, and I don't have an answer. I have to think about that, and I think it's something we could all benefit from and share, so maybe in the next couple of years we'll come up with that. That's a great question.
I think it also kind of relates that have we ever had sort of a one-stop shop? I mean, we've all inherited old accessioning numbers, old call numbers. I mean, we have a multitude of access points even in the paper world. So it's not new to us. It's something that we've always had to deal with. But in the digital world, now we're having this immediate access with all these users that might not be familiar with us. And that's the challenge, I think, is that outreach and advocacy component now that they're getting to us via Google. So it's a really good question. But, yeah, I don't know.
It's job security for us because we've got to do that mediated search so we can get them all linked
right.
together.
Right.
The question is if they found any limitations with the standard use of Dublin Core within DSpace.
Not particularly, because one of the things you can really customize for actually each collection, you can set up a separate template for a description of what you want, and so you can the Dublin Core is sort of the starting point, but you can develop up. We've got like different cores that we've called. We have a Duke Core and other different kind of cores of sort of fields for different kind of things that we have set up, and you can use these different templates for different collections, and you don't have to follow the set script. You can add in custom ones and set up your own rules. So actually I found that's one of the pieces I really actually quite like about DSpace is the flexibility for the templates you can put in. You can basically you can make a metadata thing that you could I don't know how many fields you could put in for almost an infinite number. Obviously we're trying to move things through, so we don't do that. But there's a lot of flexibility in that. So that's actually been I think a plus.
Yeah, I agree. We have a Michigan core, a double core as well, and then we expand it for collections. So, yeah, it's quite flexible.
Mm-hmm. My question is about resources and in terms of
The question is whether or not there are actual personnel whose job it is to submit material, to find and submit material, or if this is something that the archivists have had to do themselves, because that is definitely a challenge.
I'd say at Michigan, it's become part of our job description. We have the Deep Blue there has a project manager that's out of the university library and technical support, and then there's collection curators in the library, and we've all kind of just taken this on for an added responsibility.
It's been added to my responsibilities, but I also have, I've been able to incorporate some of my ingest with the technical services person that does that, a lot of the description within the library's technical services. So she was doing the scholarly output stuff as well and selection for that. So it's a little bit of both.
Yeah. And at Duke, I'd say I spend roughly 5 to 10% of my time as the site administrator, and our electronic records archivist probably spends 30 to 40% of his time, depending on what projects are going on, looking at Duke Space. And then we will pull in our graduate assistants occasionally to help us work with some of the metadata pieces. So we may have sometimes as much as a 10-15 an hour graduate student a week working on the site as well. From the IT end of things, it's done sort of by a pool. There's, I think, 4 or 5 server staff, and they sort of rotate around. So, our servers are sort of in their server maintenance rotation. And then there is one IT analyst who is sort of the DSpace expert, so that when there's things that Seth can't fix, then we have to call them in. So they're spending, 5 to 10% of their time with it as well on that end.
Dan.
It's actually probably directed more at Aaron and Nancy because it's a public records type of issue. With having a dark archive where you might want to put something to preserve it because it's the only place where it could go, you have at least some preservations going on. But it might be something potentially of a sensitive nature, so you don't really want to necessarily put it out there accessible on the World Wide Web. Although it's a public record, technically, you probably have to give it up if somebody asks for it. So if somebody ends up finding that link but saying there's no access to it because it's in the dark archive, not in the actual open repository, have you thought about policy around that? how you would handle that, if it's a good thing or a bad thing?
Hold on. I got to repeat the question. Sorry. The question is involving public records with having a dark archives if there's material that's sensitive, but it is a public record. If the outside world finds a link but can't get to it, have there been any policies developed in terms of working with that kind of material?
We didn't create a unique policy pertaining to that, but we do our public records laws and statute, but our rules guiding access to public records and storage specifications are in a state rule, and so we refer to that. And it just says that you have to be able to provide reasonable and timely access to the records. And so in the digital, we don't really have electronic records guidance. We have guidance for imaged records, so scanned records. We're trying to get the born digital component in there. And so we kind of use those as the best practices, the guidelines from the imaged ones, which is that they need to be indexed. So basically there needs to be metadata available and there needs to be reasonable access when someone asks. But it's a good question because I think, you know, saying dark archive kind might sort of make it sound as if it is secret, but it's not. It's just we more mean it, I think, in the terms of safe for preservation purposes. So,
yeah, I agree with Erin. We have regular access policies and restrictions, and all of our university records can be FOIA'd. So if they were to find it, ours is very dark, so they're not going to find a link by searching, but it would be through the finding aid, a mention in the finding aid. And that would be the same for paper records, so they'd go through the process of if it's closed or restricted, they would have to go through the FOIA process to see the record. So I'd say everything falls under the normal procedures and policies we have.
Other questions? Okay, there are two questions and then a comment. The first question was about delivering web files through DSpace, and also if they, the panelists have had administrative offices do their own ingestion, or if the archives is doing it for them. And the final comment was that if someone finds what's needed in DSpace or in the institutional repository, that that is actually a success as opposed to something to worry about.
Well, we do ingest web files, and we convert them to interactive PDFs so they still have functional links. And that's just a workflow that was established with the IR before the electronic records were there. And the other question was about...
what was it about?
Administrative offices.
Oh, well, currently our sort of approach is to have them do a transmittal of records just like they normally would do with paper records, but through a secure FTP. Or if they have another mechanism in which they want to deliver the files, and then we would do the uploading and the processing. Just based on the issues that we have when we do transmittals of paper records, we thought that might be easier. Just because it'd be better to have it. There's just a whole other component of education that I don't know if we have the current resources to deal with. That would be like an ideal, is to have them submit, and then when they submit, there's a component where then you can edit everything before it goes up, you know, public, and that would be perfect, but I don't know if we're there yet. Have you done that yet? No.
Okay. I was going to say, we've not been very effective at all. We tried several experiments of putting web pages up and have not been happy, so I'm going to go look at Erin's site to see how she did hers.
This Michigan Today project will be the web files, and that probably should go live this fall, and I can let you guys know. Yeah. But I kind of want to comment more on Elizabeth's about the, you know, worrying about when people find something. I think it relates back to Lee's observation about Google, and I think it's a great opportunity. And maybe it is a little bit of just letting go, but people today are really just, they're looking for information, they're looking for data, and sometimes I don't think they really care if it's from the if it's an archival document or not. But it's for us, it's an opportunity, and how do we best capture that opportunity We're not going to capture 100% of users because there's going to be a lot of people that really don't care. They're just looking. And if you look at, you know, if you run Google analysis on your website, you'll see just how many thousands of people are coming and not staying very long and leaving. And you'd really like to know more about what they were looking for, and you'd like to talk to them. But at this point, it's really difficult to figure out. But I think it is an opportunity, not just is to get the archival material out there, and then as if we can figure it out, how, get them back to the archives.
I think that's also a challenge because we also want them to realize that not everything is on the web.
Yeah.
That there may be exactly what they're looking for, and that's great. But if it's not quite what they're looking for because they want earlier issues that aren't digital, we probably have them in the stacks. Mm-hmm. And they have to be able to understand that, you know, yeah, okay, the digital version goes to 1994, but we've got 1960 to 1994 in our stacks. So.
There's a out of Emory's.
I gotta ask answer the question. She's sorry. She's curious about. We're all from larger institutions, but the curiosity is about smaller institutions and whether or not there's a consortium in the South that is allowing smaller institutions to piggyback on what they have done. Go ahead, Tim.
No,
sorry.
No, sorry. The only consortium that I can think of that's sort of similar to like that is the one that was started off by Emory and its several institutions working together with LOX they were doing for it, but that was all sort of a dark archive project where they were doing consortial preservation of electronic media and back files of periodicals and like that. So I know that there's that consortial thing, but I'm not familiar with a DSpace or IR one. I mean, the basic thing
is
there's Nightly has a DSpace initiative. An instance that's shared through, I don't know, maybe 25, 30 liberal arts colleges.
There's something called Nightly, which is
N-I-T-L-E.
That's based out of?
It's a nonprofit organization.
Okay, it's a nonprofit organization that has an instance where 25 to 30 small liberal arts colleges are using the version of DSpace.
N-I-T-L-E.
So there are various other places to look, is what I'll summarize for the... Is there somebody? Way in the back. The comment was, if you're in the West, check out the California repository, or Colorado repository, sorry. And also that we may have to shift from thinking of things from a collection-centered to more object-centered because a lot of these institutional repositories, you have to put things in as objects, individual object level, and the challenge is how to put thousands of objects through in a timely manner. We have time for one more question. Anyone? Yeah.
It's the CERP project, right? C-E-R-P?
If you want more information, you should listen to the recording of the session on Saturday or talk to the people at the Smithsonian about email, using DSpace for email. I'd like to thank you all for coming and like to thank our three panelists. And if you have questions...